Good morning, and welcome to the Thursday, February 4th meeting of the House Education Finance Committee. Remote hearings such as this are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members have the contents of their virtual packets available to them. And for the public, these same materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they are attached to the calendar event you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. If a member is on their phone and doesn't have access to the raise your hand feature, please email Ms. Burt and she will put your question in the queue. This is the digital equivalent of getting the attention of the chair or committee administrator. An email from your House account with the subject line, please recognize, is all that is required if you're on your phone. Ms. Sunderland, would you please take the roll?
Chair Dabney.
Present.
Vice Chair Sandsted.
Present.
Representative Kreisha.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Damath.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Thompson.
Thompson present.
Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
That is the roll, and we do have a quorum.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sunderland. Representative Erickson, have you had the chance to review the minutes from our February 3rd meeting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson moves approval of the minutes from February 3, 2021.
There we go. Thank you very much. Members, any discussion to the Erickson motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the Erickson motion to approve the February 3rd, 2021 minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Members, today we're hearing from the administration on their Due North 2021 budget and plan. It's a comprehensive plan that centers the needs of our students as we focus on catching students up academically while also supporting their social and emotional needs. First, we'll hear from Deputy Commissioner Mueller. I understand there are a handful of presenters from the department who will be presenting at various points. Before you begin your portion of the presentation, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Members will take questions throughout the presentation. Deputy Commissioner Mueller, pardon me, you have the stage. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Thank you, everybody. It's nice to be here today, and we appreciate having the opportunity to come and talk to you today about our Due North plan. Chair Dabney, would you like everyone to introduce themselves from the team, or would you like for them to do that when they start their part of the presentation?
Why don't we do that when they start their part of the presentation?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I think we're going to pull up the presentation. The first thing that we're going to walk through is just if we look at the second slide, is the 10 commitments to equity. Part of the foundational principles of the Department of Education is to be really thoughtful and purposeful as we consider and move toward equity and ensuring that access, representation, and participation for every single student, regardless and including race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, gender, sexuality, and ability. And it's incredibly important for us to continue to have these at the forefront as decisions are made, not only in the policies and the practices, but also around our budgetary decisions. As you've heard the governor and the lieutenant governor articulate that a budget is a reflection of the values of an administration, and you put your money for where you value. And so what we're going to walk through with you today are components of what has been identified for both the Due North plan and how it is that we've articulated the funding that goes with that to represent our values. In the Due North Plan, we can move to the next slide, please. Thank you. In the Due North Plan, it helps to lay out a couple of different pieces that are intertwined. First and foremost, the Due North Plan identifies 7 priority areas that cover a variety of pieces that really lay the foundation for the work that needs to be done to continue to build on a strong education system. But what we need to make sure that we have is a strong education system for all students. So we are not having desperate and disparities between our students of color and Indigenous students and our white students, and are also considering and thinking about our students who also receive special education services and students who also receive EL services. In addition, that is the building on that for the Minnesota Department of Education Strategic Plan. The Minnesota Department of Education Strategic Plan really helps to take those 7 priorities and the strategies that have been identified and then puts them into additional buckets that helps to identify the strategies that align with that. As a result, those are some of the pieces on how we are going to be able to meet what has been identified in the Due North Plan. In order to be able to do this, we've identified a budget that we believe reflects the values and of the administration, as well as helps to move the needle in focusing on a Department of Education and an education system and structure that is specifically supporting every single student every single day. For the 2021 budget, we are moving forward $146.75 million this summer and $662.24 million in the fall of 2022 and 2023 in the biennium. In those 7 priorities, we have meeting the needs of students during and after the pandemic. We recognize that there was work to do in our education system and structure prior to the pandemic. And during the pandemic, we have had additional identifications of continued splits in what we are able to provide, how we are able to provide that service, and recognizing that we have work to continue to do, not only then in this process, but how are we going to continue to rebuild and to support as we move into the fall. Also considering how it is that we are going to ensure that every student receives a world-class education, every student learns in an environment that is safe and nurturing, that they are in classrooms with caring and qualified teachers, that we are expanding our opportunities for our students of color and our Indigenous students, as well as expanding opportunities for students in Greater Minnesota, and then funding that 21st century education. The basic components and tenets of this plan are really focused on making sure that every single student sees themselves in their schooling, they see themselves in who is educating them, they are in an environment that builds on who they are and values who they are and what they bring to the table with them every single day when they walk through those doors, and it values their families. Our students are coming in and our families are sending us the very best that they have every single day, and those are in our students. And this is going to give us the opportunity to continue to build upon that, recognizing that we have work that we need to do in order to move from having wide gaps to really closing those gaps and lifting students. As we think about MDE strategic plan and its alignment to the Due North plan, it is really driven by equity and inclusion, and it's the product of input from our Minnesota educators, our families, and our students. And it's also shaped by the governor and lieutenant governor's vision of a Department of Education, as well as what it is we are going to be able to do to support students, families, and educators now and into the future. Reflecting that again are all of those pieces. And what you'll also see in addition to those 7 is you also have the addition that the Department of Education will provide leadership, support, and partnership to every public school district and charter school across the state. And throughout this pandemic, we need to acknowledge that we have had amazing partnership with our school districts and our charter schools and with our private schools across the state, because we are all working to ensure the safety, health, and wellness of our students and staff, and working to ensure the ability to prioritize in-person learning. When we're talking about where we want to start, right, a lot of conversations have been had about what we're doing in our school year now, but we know that if we're thinking about also where we need to go, we need to be thinking about this summer. How is it that we are going to help our students come back into their school buildings? It doesn't mean that they have not been learning, but we also know that it has been very difficult for a number of our students. And so we want to ensure that we have a way to be able to help to support and prioritize in-person learning and continue to support our students and staff as they navigate coming back into the building. We want to be able to expand our opportunities for mental health as well as academic support services. We recognize the toll that this has taken on our students and our staff and their mental health and well-being. And we also want to ensure that our students are on grade level and are going to continue to be able to move forward without having the pandemic change the trajectory of their academic careers. We also are looking at providing a one-time investment to ensure that the pandemic enrollment loss does not negatively impact our students, meaning that this is really an opportunity for us to look at. We know that we had some students who moved out of the public school into a different setting, whether that's in a homeschool setting or a private school setting, for a variety of reasons. But that does not also mean that we are not going to have students who are going to continue to be participating in our public education. And we know that that means that we want to continue the strong programs that exist. We don't want to have to cut staff or any types of programs in a one term, in a 1 year shift. And so really want to be able to continue to help support our schools and charter schools as we're walking through and coming back and coming out of this pandemic. And this package is something that we need to pass earlier rather than later. And simply because we know that this is the point in time, February actually is when we start as school districts and charter schools really thinking about staffing for summer, really working with our families and talking about summer programming and really helping to identify who needs to be able to participate, how we're going to be able to help to participate, and then how we're going to be able to staff that. And so our ability to be able to communicate this information and the funding to our school districts and charter school as soon as possible is incredibly important. As we look specifically at what are the components of the summer package, we've talked a little bit about targeting the academic and the mental health supports of our students. It really gives us the opportunity to expand programming, meaning that oftentimes summer programming is helped to either reinforce what has been taught over the past school year or to help to reteach some of those pieces. And it's usually identified for a smaller group of students. We recognize that students across the state will need to have access to summer programming, and so we want to be able to expand access and expand the number of students who are able to participate. We also want to make sure that we are incorporating and expanding mental health supports. We have amazing counselors, school psychologists, social workers, school nurses who work in our schools across the state. And we want to ensure that as students are coming back into their building or continuing, we have a number of schools that have been in this whole time. And so I want to be really conscious of saying that. As we say we're coming back into the building, we mean on a consistent basis where we're not maybe having to transition learning models because the virus is either more under control or we have more vaccines and more testing. But what we want to make sure is that as we are having students in our buildings consistently, that we're not only reinforcing their academic components, but we're really building on their social emotional needs and their learning. You've heard the Lieutenant Governor talk about every student having an ACE. We had students who had an ACE and more prior to walking into this pandemic. But as we think about this, this gives us the opportunity to also utilize our school experts, school psychologists, social workers, counselors, nurses, to help to support the mental health of not only our students, but our staff. Also making sure that we can think about how we provide community partnerships, neighborhood programs, field trips, and hands-on learning and tutoring opportunities. An example of that is we recognize that our schools are sometimes, summer programming is sometimes very school-centric, is based solely in what's happening in that school. And we know that students have a lot of priorities or responsibilities outside of school, especially during the summer. And so it gives us the opportunity to take our academic programming and our mental health and social emotional learning supports and move them into neighborhoods and communities. We can utilize apartment buildings where we have a number of students who are residing to be able to help to support them and if they have any responsibilities of helping to support their siblings. And so we can move into parks, but it really helps to give a focus in a different way and think about summer programming vastly differently. We also want to make sure that our students who are our preschool students, 4- and 5-year-olds, who have also had some interruption in their learning, they have the opportunity to have some continuity and continue to build those strong preschool program skills as they are walking into their kindergarten years. We've talked about the programming and support for our pandemic enrollment loss. We also know that as we're thinking really broadly about the students that we serve through the Department of Education and statewide, we're looking at students really from birth all the way through adult, right? Also, we have students who are coming back to school for a variety of reasons, whether that's to get their GED, they're learning another language, if they're coming back to EL programming at adult basic education, and also are learning new skills as they're in adult basic education. in that summer programming, we also know that we have a point in time where we have students who are going to be graduating from high school. They are not eligible to actually go back and have any summer type of programming or support. And they also are not technically either in the workforce or in their career or in a 2-year or 4-year institution or certification program. So we are asking also to look at how is it that we might be able to look at our recent graduates and provide them with the opportunity to enroll in some type of post-secondary options to be able to help to support and bridge their learning as they're continuing into the fall. And then, like we said, expand opportunities for our adult learners as well. As we're thinking about additional ways we're going to be able to fund this, we're really looking at using both GEAR and ESSER funds, the ESSER II funds, to be able to expand the number of teachers that we have to provide in-person academic instruction. It means that it's roughly $57.5 million in federal funds to be able to help to support this. They can also be used to help reduce class sizes because we know that we are going to want to have some physical distancing happening in our classrooms. It allows us to offer summer programming for more hours, for more days. It allows us to have those community and organization partnerships, things like mentorship programs and partnering, providing student transportation, and which is going to be farther reaching the more students that we have, and also looking at making sure that we have the PPE that our staff needs to be able to continue to provide support and services throughout the summer session. And so these are really looking at being funded in a variety of ways, one of which would be looking at membership hours. As we're looking at school-aged care and youth programming, which is roughly $15.497 million, we're really thinking about how it is that we're going to be able to allocate GEARS funds to address the needs of in-school school-age care programs, and recognizing that we may have some schools that for a variety of reasons may need to transition during the summer if they have a robust summer program because they may have a COVID outbreak that is in fact impacting their building, and they may need to transition their learning models maybe into a hybrid model. If that is the case, we want to make sure that we are able to support our families as they are going into work to make sure that they continue to have access to some type of care programs provided and through our schools and through our partnerships. And also thinking about how it is we can look at thinking about our school age care before, after, and then our summer school and youth wraparound programs. And here it really articulates looking at our school age care staffing and administration, providing access to increased before and after school programmings, as well as early learning scholarships to our wait list, and increasing the number of students who have the availability to that and reducing the costs. In the mental health supports, there are two ways we're thinking about this. One is continuing to expand on the DHS school-linked mental health grants. It means that they have the opportunity to serve approximately 8,100 students in more than 1,100 Minnesota school sites. They not only can help to support and contract for hours and consultations with our students, but will also be able to help to support staff who have also been through an incredibly trying time and also have an ACE. In addition, it's making sure that we have our experts that are on our staff, like I said, in our counselors, social workers, school psychologists, and school nurses, who are going to be able to remain working throughout the summer to be able to help to support and reinforce building social emotional learning and helping in not only in whole group instruction, but also maybe having some small groups and some one-on-one time with students. In our partnerships, what we've talked just a little bit about is thinking about how is it that we can partner with our local communities. We have had an amazing amount of outreach from our local community and business partners asking about how they can help. What is it that they can do to not only help to support, but reinforce our students and our staffs and their families as we continue to walk through this pandemic? And so thinking about how we can build those is how do we build mentoring type programs between some of our communities and businesses and our students? How do we continue to build that and set up a professional development opportunity to not only build that system and structure and a grant process, but also to be able to maintain that continuity so that we have a mentorship program or some type of, that's an example of one, but to be able to kind of have to help build that as we go. Also thinking about how is it that we're going to, like we said, do some of those neighborhood programs? So how do we take it from a school-centric approach to really looking at our community, recognizing the implications for our students, and understanding where a number of our students are at as they're in the summertime? And so that's another way we hope to be able to do that. And then tutoring services. again, we know that they are going to have students who need time with their education staff and with their teachers in school. And we also have students who are going to need some additional time around with tutoring. And so how do we partner again with some of our local organizations and nonprofits who have been incredibly supportive to be able to help to support in those wraparound services, provide academic enrichment and mental health supports. So that way in that partnership, if there is a need for more of a full day approach, that we have that partnership to be able to build. And then finally, field trips and hands-on learning. We know that there have been a number of students who have not been able to be in their school building, or they have not been able to do a lot of exploring or see a lot of what we have to offer and apply their knowledge and what they're learning in hands-on ways, in the ways that we may have been able to do that in the past. So we really want to provide opportunities for students to be able to continue to use what they're learning in their summer programmings, apply it into real life experiences, and have the opportunity to see some of the great and amazing things we have available to us in Minnesota. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Assistant Commissioner Bobby Burnham.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Mueller. Before we do that, Representative Erickson has a question. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Deputy Commissioner. It's always fun to see you and interesting to listen to you. If we do agree to the $75 million infusion for the current school year, what measure of success or achievement are you going to expect at the end of that programming?
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, and thank you, Representative Erickson. So there are a couple of pieces. As school districts bring students in, part of what is historically done in that programming is to do some baseline assessment. We have, so as students are coming in, you are able to do a baseline assessment, and then as you are doing instruction, you progress monitor where students are at. And then at the end of that summer programming, you will have results. And so you're able to see student growth over the time of instruction. You can have that in reading. You can, there are also supports for progress monitoring in math. And so we know that there are also curricular-based resources that are classroom-based assessments that also can be utilized, but really it's using local assessments, whether that's in an NWEA, a FAST, a DIBELS, to be able to look at where students are coming in and then progress monitor over the weeks that they are provided, that they are learning in instruction. And then at the end of that time, they usually have some type of report out that provides information about the amount of growth that students have had.
Mr. Chair,
thank you. Just finally, can we expect rather specific language then in the bill that you submit, in particular for the catch-up that at least I'm expecting over the summer?
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you very much, Chair Dabney. And again, thank you very much, Representative Erickson. So we are going to look at how is it that we are going to work with our school leaders as well as thinking about how do we put in language that helps to reinforce growth over time. It's something that schools do naturally as part of what we do throughout the summer. And so to look at that growth over that time, our goal is to continue to talk about in any summer programming, how do you reinforce language? How do you reinforce education? But in some instances, this may be the very first time they're learning it. And so we're not only putting that in language in to be able to help support what they've learned in general, but also look at that growth over time.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was it.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just ask a broad question that, and I won't ask it for every testifier, but could you walk me through, and as each testifier talks about the process of the budget, what kind of needs analysis did you do, and what were the process, or what were the priorities that you were trying to solve in order, just give me the top three or four. I'm just looking to see how you prioritize things and how you recognize things that needed to be solved. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, and thank you, Representative Kreisha. So there's a couple of pieces. One, the governor and lieutenant governor pulled together a round table, which were about 21 people from across the state with a variety of perspectives to come in and to talk about what has been not only identified as a need for education in general, but also to really target what has been needed as a result of the pandemic, where we are seeing our disparities continue to grow and what we need to be able to focus on as an education system. The second is we had the opportunity to do focus groups through the Department of Education with our with families, with parents, with students, with educators, with teachers, paraprofessionals, our school leaders, as to be sure that we are looking at not only what do we need throughout this pandemic, but what are some of the pieces we need to be able to do to continue to move forward. And so we learned and heard a lot in those focus groups. In addition, we have had the opportunity to go, and the commissioners had the opportunity to go across the state and have listening sessions and opportunities not only with our with constituents in each of those communities, but really bringing together a number of groups to be able to talk about where it is we need to go and what we need to do. And so those pieces have been identified in a variety of ways. What we have heard consistently is one, we need to make sure that we're closing the gap that results that we have in a racial disparity, as well as demographic disparity and disparities for our students who are receiving special education services and those that are receiving English learner services. So those were clearly identified and articulated. We also heard that we need to support ongoing learning. How is it that we are going to help to, in this interrupted point of instruction, help to reinforce and support our students, not only academically, but also their mental health and their social emotional learning. So that was another really clear message that we have heard consistently in these conversations. And then finally, I think you asked for the third, because there have been a lot, right? And I think that in the third one, what we're really have heard about is that we need to be thoughtful about how is it that we can also support our school staff. Right, because they also are coming out of working it through this pandemic, and how is it that we're going to continue to be able to provide support and professional development in the skills and reinforcement of a system and structure that really helps to get at eliminating disparities and gaps and growing the social emotional learning and support of our mental health of our students and staff.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And no, just a quick follow-up. So that's great. I appreciate the conversation. I also would be interested in if folks have this in the other presentations, what data analytics you used. In other words, you know, the anecdotes are great and the listening sessions are important, but what did you compare it back to? How did you measure which problems actually needed to be attacked?
All right. Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Mueller. I was looking and listening to the presentation, looking at the slides. We have some financial issues with schools that are caused largely because of government's reaction to this pandemic. And I think a lot of us will argue that the kids should be in school like many other states they are. They should, and I know they are going back into school now, but it seems that this budget proposal simply throws more money at solving the problems caused by those decisions. For instance, the additional mental health dollars that are being brought forward here for hiring additional people supposedly to fix the mental health issues that arose because of what government did to the schools related to the pandemic. So don't you think that when we actually remove these barriers to our local schools and let them operate again, that the governor's caused mental health issues on these students will go away?
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, and thank you very much, Representative Drazkowski. I think that a couple of things. What you see is for the summer part of this program, what we've talked about is really looking at maintaining that mental health support as we're going through the summer. We also know that as a state, we are one of the lowest, if not the lowest, as it goes to a student and staff ratio as it pertains to counselors, social workers, school psychologists, and nurses. And so this isn't just a reaction to what has happened throughout the pandemic. It is because we have been irresponsible in not having the student to staff ratio to be able to provide counseling and social worker and school supports in school psychologists and our nurses. And so the rest of that funding is really actually targeted at a problem that we've had for a number of years and helping to rectify that issue. And so that what you're talking about is a component, that very first part of the summer, but the rest of that is actually looking specifically at maintaining those supports. Because we have seen, like I said, you do see that we have had, based even on the Minnesota Student Survey, we have a number of students who have seen an increase in mental health struggles and recognize whether that's through depression or anxiety, or suicidal thoughts. We also know that that is something that we have got to help to target. And so at this point, we are thinking about how it is we're going to maintain and support that throughout the summer. But what we also need to be is forward thinking and recognize that we have the data that has shown that our students are struggling and we don't have the staff to be able to support them. And that's what those dollars are actually targeted for.
Representative Drazkowski, a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, just a comment on that and then another question, Mr. Chair. What I'm hearing from parents is that they just need to get their kids back in school. And we continue to, in the education area and other areas throughout government, simply the idea is that if we throw more money at things, that will fix it. All we have to do is stop doing these things to these schools and let them operate. And that's what I'm hearing from parents. So I wish that Deputy Commissioner, you and the governor would listen to those parents because they're not being heard, and their kids in those cases would benefit tremendously in their mental health by simply being allowed back in school full time and allowing them to operate regularly without these inhibitions that have been brought forward by these very extreme policies. So the third bullet on your second or third frame here talks about provide a one-time investment to ensure pandemic enrollment losses do not negatively impact students. So Deputy Commissioner, does that mean that we're going to pay more money to educate less kids?
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Davini and Representative Drazkowski. What it means is that it's going to recognize that the funding that our staff and our schools have utilized for staffing and for programs maintains that consistency for a one-year period. And then if there were less students that were moving into the next year, that it then that would not be the case. But what it does is provides a year of consistency to see if there's continuity in that enrollment drop, or if we are going to see a resurgence of students who are coming back into the public school setting or into that particular school.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you. Representative Sanstey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may, I just would like to respond to the question slash comment from Representative Drazkowski. And what I would like to say to that is I just want to put a great big exclamation point after everything the Deputy Commissioner said in terms of the funding needed for built out mental health supports in our public schools and for students. I have been teaching in the classroom for 27 years, and I just, again, left on leave about a month ago to come down and do my work with the legislature. And over the course of 27 years, I have seen the needs of our students increasing mental health needs long before the pandemic, far before the pandemic. So I need to just really articulate that the issues that we see in classrooms, the students' mental health needs, are not just because of the government's response to a pandemic. They're absolutely not. Absolutely not. And our need for social workers, school counselors, school nurses is extreme in all of our districts. We have a need that we basically are not able to keep up with. And that's not because of the pandemic. So this money is desperately needed for those things. Teachers are we're hired to educate. But in reality, and I know we've talked about this in our committee over the course of several terms, you know, we are far more than just delivering academics. We are trying to stand in the gap. We are trying to be the bridge for so many needs that we are not the experts in, that we are not trained in, nor should we be. That is not our role. So we do need these other professionals to help meet the needs of our students. So when they are in our classrooms, when we are instructing, they are prepared and able to learn. So those are my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sandstein. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Chair. Hey, I just wanted to echo Representative Sandstein and her comments. I know kids who, you know, it was a triple murder, triple homicide, just right up the street from my house. Three kids were murdered and their parents. It's post-George Floyd, post-pandemic. We opened the floodgates when we said, let's put all the kids in school. They're coming back to that school with a boatload of mental health, trauma, issues. The pandemic is going to cause an epidemic for my community. And another thing is, this is just the last piece. You know, some of this stuff is like some of the same stuff. And we try to do the same thing and expect a different result, which is insane. We definitely need mental health professionals, culturally competent mental health professionals, and teachers and administrators, culturally competent mental health professionals, teachers and administrators. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. With that, let's move on to Bobby Burnham, Assistant Commissioner. Assistant Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dabney and committee members. My name is Bobby Burnham. I serve as the Assistant Commissioner and oversee the Office of Teaching and Learning at the Department of Ed. I'm going to share a couple slides with you that are a continuation of our summer package. The first one being expanded preschool access for 4 and 5 year olds during the summer. Our intent is to fill those gaps with children who, due to COVID, may not have had the opportunity to go to pre-K or even to kindergarten. So it's about continuity of care. And we know from hearing from our school districts that kindergarten enrollment was down due to COVID this year. So this is an effort to offer the high quality early learning opportunity for those kids. It will be targeted at free and reduced priced lunch children that meet one of the following eligibility categories, being foster care, children in child protection, those experiencing homelessness, or children of teenage parents. Children who fall under multiple categories will have the highest priorities to receive these services. Any remaining seats will then be offered to families who can participate on a sliding fee scale. We also intend that other program requirements continue to meet the school year standards that are currently in place around school readiness, BPK, and school readiness plus, as well as Head Start and our three and four star rated parent aware programs. We intend that the use of these funds will cover costs of tuition, transportation, food service, and interpreters for multilingual supports for eligible students. The next piece of our summer package is related to our older learners, so college readiness and adult education. So summer college for high school graduates. Courses may be either credit-bearing or developmental, but may not begin until the student has received their diploma. Post-secondary institutions may opt to participate in the program. Funding would be used to reimburse Minnesota public post-secondary institutions for the cost of tuition, with ranges from approximately $165 to $512, depending on the institution and the program. Reimbursements would be prorated if expenses exceed the funding available. While there were not be a limit on the number of credits a student could take, it is assumed that most students would take 1 to 2 courses for a total of between 4 and 6 credits. The funding for this program would provide approximately 4.5% of graduating seniors to take 6 credits of college courses over the summer. For our adult basic ed learners, local adult basic ed programs would use this funding to increase their programming statewide, including English language learning, a standard adult high school diploma, high school equivalency preparation, adult career pathway programming, and help purchase devices and internet access and hotspots for adult learners, provide more high school equivalency testing, and launch additional and more robust programming that is currently too expensive pertaining to adult career pathway programming. Collaborate with workforce development partners, post-secondary institutions, and employers to expand career services, navigation services, and integrated education and training programs to help adults, including the English learners and those reentering the workforce. And then there is a proposal in here with our partners over at Office of Higher Ed as well, for summer academic enrichment program and intervention for college attendance programs. And with that, I will turn it over to Terry Yetter, our Director of School Finance.
Thank you very much. Ms. Yetter, welcome to the back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Ms. Yetter, you need to unmute yourself.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Terry Yetter. I'm the School Finance Director here at the Department of Education. And the section I'm going to be covering is dealing with the proposals for funding for 21st century education. These include a formula allowance increase in the Gen Ed formula, improvement in the cross subsidy for both special education and English language learner programs, and in simplifying school finance, a few of the school finance formulas and improving equalization. This also includes several low cost or no cost items, which I'll cover at the end of this section. So the first item is the formula allowance increase. This is recommending a 1% increase for FY22 and an additional 2.5% increase in FY23. This would be about $66 per pupil on the formula in the first year, and then an additional $166 in the second year of the formula. General education revenue, or the basic formula, accounts for about 60% of total E12 education aid for this current school year. In addition to improving the basic education revenue, it also improves some of the formulas that are linked to the formula allowance, and these would include compensatory revenue, sparsity revenue, and transportation sparsity revenue within the general education revenue program, and then also early childhood family education revenue, and then aid for non-public pupils, non-public transportation, and then general education aid for shared time programs. The formula allowance has lagged behind inflation for quite a number of years over the last two decades. And this has caused more of a reliance on operating referendums for school districts to support their basic programs. And even though there's been a 2% increase in the formula allowance for each of the last 7 years, it hasn't made up for some of the erosion in purchasing power for many of the earlier years within this two-decade period. And so due to inflation, the FY21 basic education formula per pupil is about $658 less than it was in FY03 when you adjust for inflation as measured by the CPI. Then on the next slide, the next item is freezing a portion of the special education cross subsidy. Here we're looking to hold a cross subsidy at an amount per student that would be roughly equivalent to the FY19 level. of $808 per average data membership student. And this would increase the cross-subsidy reduction from 6.43% to 9.33% in FY22, and then 13.2% for 23 and later years. Special ed cross-subsidy does continue to grow. Between 2009 and 2019, state special education aid per student increased from about $1,100 per student to about $1,800 per student. The cross-subsidy is the unfunded cost of special education programs for students with disabilities, which school districts and charter schools need to cover using unrestricted general fund resources, which is primarily their general education revenue. The state and federal special education aid formulas pay currently about 75% of special education costs. That's about 68% for the state formula and about 70% for the federal formulas. So as cross-subsidy grows, school districts and charter schools have fewer resources available in their general fund to maintain quality education programs and improve achievement for all students. Then the next slide, there's a proposal also to improve the cross-subsidy within the English learner programs. And for this one, we're looking to increase the EL cross-subsidy, or I'm sorry, to reduce the EL cross-subsidy from $123 million, or about 67% of EL expenditures, to about $108 million, or about 59% of expenditures. This particular provision was a variation of the recommendations that came out of our school finance working group earlier this year. And for EL students, has increased, the number of EL students or students needing EL services has increased from 6.3% of total enrollment to about 8% of total enrollment. Current EL funding covers about one third of the EL costs. And so the cross subsidy impacts districts for about two thirds of the costs for providing these services. The EL formulas were enacted back in 2003, effective for the FY2004 school year. And the allowances that are used in those formulas has remained flat over this entire time period. So the formula parameters, including the initial allowance per EL student of $704 and the concentration allowance and the percentage cap on the concentration has remained the same over this long time period. And so the cross subsidy within the EL programs has grown significantly, you know, over the years.
Ms. Yetter, if you could pause here. Representative Jordan has a question. Representative Jordan?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Ms. Yetter, for all this great information. And I'm really glad to see that we're working to reduce the EL cross-subsidy. Can you talk a little bit about what it would take from the state to fully fund special education? I see that we're holding that cross-subsidy steady, which is, I'm glad that it's not increasing. But how much would it take to get to reduce that cross-subsidy as well from our state? And we obviously have our federal partners there as well. Pardon. So, but what would it take for the state to do it?
Pardon me, Representative Jordan. Ms. Yetter.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan, this is a modest increase in the funding that is being proposed for helping to just hold the cross subsidy steady. If I don't have the number in front of me for how much it would take to fully pay for special ed, but I can get that for you.
Representative Jordan.
Yep. Thank you, Ms. Yetter. I know I would be very, very interested in that. I think we've talked a lot about how we need to make sure that we're supporting all of our students there. So I think we should think about how we can get to that number. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Ms. Yetter. I'm wondering if the department is talking to the Biden administration and to the Congress about increasing the promised up to 40% funding for special education, because this is the perfect time to do that.
Ms. Yetter, any response?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. If I could defer to one of the others on our team to respond to that question.
Certainly.
Chair Dabney.
Certainly. Deputy Commissioner Mueller, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dabney, and thank you for the question, Representative Erickson. We, as you know, the confirmation and work for moving forward with a Secretary of Education just moved forward this week. And so we are going to be consistently reaching out on a number of different things to be able to have that conversation. We have been waiting patiently. And so now we are super excited to be able to talk to them about what some of the possibilities are going to look like, not only as it pertains to special education funding, but what some of their other platforms are going to be and how we're going to be able to move forward.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just note that when I was meeting with the Biden administration before the inauguration, I brought that up, and so did many of my colleagues across the nation. So let's hope they pay attention to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Yetter.
The next area is simplifying school levies and improved equalization. We have three different revenue programs that are included in this. Local optional revenue, LOR, and operating referendums, and then debt service equalization. And the proposal here is to replace and simplify the equalization funding formulas for these three programs, replacing the two-tier equalization aid formulas with a single tier, and then also increasing the equalization for each of these programs. These are also a variation on the recommendations that were made by the School Finance Working Group. The simplifying of these formulas also improves equalization by essentially bringing the lower tier of equalization up closer to what the higher tier of equalization would be. This improves equalization that's needed as the equalization in these formulas erode over time. What tends to happen is these programs, at least the first two, are based on a fixed equalizing factor. And as tax bases grow and the calculation based on tax base per pupil, the levy share will tend to increase with a fixed equalizing factor, and the aid share will tend to decrease over time. So when these formulas are improved, they do tend to have that improvement erode as time goes on. For the for each of these programs, for each of these programs also, the tax base per pupil tends to be lower in a lot of our outstate school districts. And so those are some of the areas that of the state that would particularly be benefited from these proposals. And I should also mention that attached to this meeting agenda, there are four different runs that show the impact of these major formula changes on both the revenues for school districts and charter schools, and then on the change between state aid and local property tax levy for the equalization measures. So for the LOR and operating referendum, these are both considered to be general purpose revenues, and they supplement what is provided by the basic general education formula. Since they have a levy component, they are harder to access for districts with low tax bases. So, as I said, this impacts many districts, particularly in greater Minnesota. The first $300 of LOR is equalized at a relatively high rate $880,000 per pupil based on the referendum market value tax base. And this is currently about 130% of the statewide average tax base per pupil. The remaining portion of LOR is equalized at a lower rate, $510 per pupil, and that's about 81% of the state average tax base per pupil. The new single tier would be equalized at 123% of the state average tax base. And so what you see is the equalization improves significantly in the second tier by combining it into a single tier. For the operating referendum, the first three, $460 is equalized at $776 per pupil. That's a slightly higher rate than what we have for the second tier of LOR. This rate is about the same as the LOR. The second tier is only equalized at about 43% of the statewide average pupil unit. And so the single tier would make all of the referendum equalization at about 85% of the statewide average. Then for debt service levies, they are equalized on also a two-tier basis, where the equalization is provided at a higher rate for the larger amounts of debt revenue, and then it's only equalized after the first threshold of debt revenue. And so the replacement would be right now the first tier is equalized at about 53% of the statewide average tax base, which is on adjusted net tax capacity. And then the second tier for the higher amounts is equalized at 100%. So this proposal would make the single tier also to be at 100%. For the debt levies, they're equalized based on the three-year prior pupil units. And what that does is it means that the equalization calculation that splits the revenue between aid and levy is a finalized calculation at the time that the levies would be set. And so for the other two programs, the proposal also recommends that that these two equalization calculations be moved to the three-year prior pupil units. What that does is provides more predictability for school districts to be able to budget for the revenue that comes in for those programs. Then on the next slide are several items that are no cost that are included in the package. The first one is linking programs to the general education formula allowance. This does have a cost, but since it's starting in the proposal for FY24, and there is no formula allowance currently in place for 24 and 25, it's showing as a no-cost item in our package. The categorical programs that are recommended to be linked in addition to what we already have linked, would include English learner revenue, the LOR revenue, extended time revenue, and then American Indian Education Aid. All of these programs have, as we've already mentioned with the EL programs, these other programs also have been based on an allowance that has not been changed for the majority of the time that they have been revenue programs, providing revenue to districts. And so this would help also to mitigate the issues that these programs have with the purchasing power being eroded each time with inflation. Then the next item is the ABE formula hold harmless. And what this does is it just clarifies the statute on the ABE funding growth formula to confirm that the growth formula projections would not mean that funding would automatically decrease from one year to the next if growth tends to decrease. The intent of the formula was to provide an increase for increasing years. And so it was kind of an unforeseen events that that would mean that it would actually show a decrease in the revenue formula. We did seek an Attorney General's opinion on this, and they do support this recommendation. Then the next item is the compensatory revenue spent at generating sites. This is one of the few formulas where the revenue is calculated and generated at the site level rather than the district level. Currently, there is a requirement within statute that 50% of the revenue be spent at the generating site. This proposal would increase that percentage to 80%. And then the next item is dealing with tax or increment financing. School districts have an adjustment made to their aid and levy that makes the revenue that they receive from tax increment financing essentially revenue neutral. And we discovered that one of the base years that's used for that calculation was not updated at the same time that the calculation for the abatement formula was updated. And as an unforeseen consequence, we've been implementing the law with the incorrect base year. So what we're doing is just proposing a technical amendment to correct that base year. Those formulas tend to work the same across those two different provisions. Abatement aid provides additional revenue based on the formula. The TIF portion of it is an aid and levy reduction to match up with the revenue. But the formulas have over the years always been kept in parallel with each other. So this is just an unforeseen departure from that. And then finally, we have basic schools and state schools revenue. This is just some technical changes that are made to the statute to better align the language and statute for the revenue uses for these two programs with the reporting requirements in UFARS. We feel that this will help to help school districts to better able to align their actual financial reporting with the specific uses that are spelled out in statute. That concludes this section. If there are any other questions on these provisions.
Thank you, Ms. Yetter. It appears that Representative Erickson has a question. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Yetter, would you explain why that first item linking to the general education formula is under no cost? Because in my mind, there will be a cost. So why would that be listed under no cost item?
Ms. Yetter?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson. It really has to do with the year that it is going to be effective with the proposal. You are absolutely correct. If this was to start in FY22 or FY23 with the formula allowances that are also in the recommendation, there would be a cost. And so we would anticipate that if a formula allowance was added for FY24 or future years, there would be a cost associated with it. So it's really a little bit of a misnomer calling it a no cost. It's no cost to our current biennial budget, but there is some there would be some potential for cost in future years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Yetter.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Ms. Yetter, are there other, does that complete your testimony? And if so, who are you handing it off to?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to turn it back to Heather.
All right. Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. So when we start to talk about every student learning in a safe and nurturing environment, it really goes back to some of the pieces we talked about earlier in this hearing. Our student support personnel are first off, nope. Our full service community schools, multi-tiered systems of support, maintaining our VPK seats and requiring an assessment profile, as well as some of our other early learning provisions. And so when we start thinking about the data that we do have on our students and also thinking about what we know and as a research and evidence-based practices, first and foremost, when we think about our student support personnel, it's a three-pronged approach. We need to fund to have up to, at this point, what we're able to provide is 325 more student personnel staff. We also want to make sure that we are funding a workforce development initiative and hiring a school health services specialist. In fiscal year 2017, Minnesota had just one counselor for every 659 students. Minnesota's to student to counselor ratio was 45% over the national average of 455 students per counselor. And there were only four states that had a higher student to counselor ratio than the state of Minnesota. And that is applicable not only for our counselors, but you will see that repeated in our social workers, school psychologists, and our school nurses. This proposal will address shortages of student support services personnel within the Minnesota schools. It'll decrease caseloads for existing student support services personnel to ensure the effective services. It'll ensure that students receive effective academic guidance and integrated and comprehensive services to improve kindergarten through grade 12 school outcomes and career and college readiness. It'll also help to ensure that student support services personnel serve within the scope and practice of their training and licensure. It'll help to fully integrate learning supports, instruction, and school management within a comprehensive approach that facilitates interdisciplinary collaboration, and will help to overall improve the school safety and climate of a school supporting the academic success and career and college readiness. When we look at specifically targeting increasing personnel, its participating districts would receive $22 per pupil or $35,000, whichever is greater. It helps to identify that this aid would be limited to the actual new costs of providing support services each year, assuming that an average cost of $80,000 per position, and the program would fund roughly 325 positions statewide beginning in fiscal year 22 and an increase of 19%. We know that in 2018, the full-time equivalence of school nurses, psychologists, school social workers, and counselors was roughly 3,815. In 2019, it was 3,918, which is an increase of 2.7%. The number of our chemical health practitioners are incredibly important, but that is not readily available to us at this point. And so the cost of this portion of the proposal is estimated to be roughly $41.864 million in the fiscal year 22 and 23, and $49.772 million in the 24-25 budget. And that would be paid out as an aid entitlement on a 90% current year appropriation and 10% prior year appropriation. In addition to needing to not only have the workforce in place now, we also recognize that we have a pipeline issue. We need to ensure that we have the workforce to be who are going to go into this field and who are going to not only go into this field, but have a place to go once they earn their additional degree. And so what we would like to be able to do is really focus in on strategies that are going to increase student support personnel of color. We are going to looking specifically at also specializing 100 into school psychologists and 100 school counselors, and really thinking about how it is not only recruiting, but also retaining them in our programs. It's going to also give us the opportunity to add capacity at the Department of Education to align health services related work that's distributed across the agency in special education, early learning services, school support, full service community schools initiatives, as well as the Improving School Health Grant. Through the work in our Nutrition, Health, and Youth Development Division. So really gives us the opportunity to focus in and hone in on, one, building the capacity within our schools, and two, building the pipeline for us to be able to do our work. The third prong in this is the building of full-service community schools. And so we know the research behind and evidence for full-service community schools, that the more that you are able to wrap services around students and the more that that is able to come through your school settings, that it gives you the opportunity to really help to support not only their student health and well-being, but also their academic, their social, emotional, their mental health growth, and their engagement. It's an evidence-based model. It's designed specifically to improve, again, support for our students and families. In the Full Service Community School Grant Program, it was established roughly in 2015, and that provided funding to eligible schools to plan, implement, and improve their Full Service Community School models. Additional funds were also then appropriated in 2017 for the expansion of that program, and this program provides an additional 13 grants to schools 4 in round 1 and 9 additional schools in round 2. And this is one of those pieces that we're not only looking at expanding, like with just in general, but also recognizing the ability to be able to support this in our greater Minnesota communities. And I believe, Bobby, you're going to step in and talk about multi-tiered systems of supports.
Assistant Commissioner Burnham.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, and committee members. As many of you know, multiple districts are working to implement a multi-tiered system of support. So this proposal is really looking at to provide really a deep and intentional level of support statewide to be more intentional and be really selective with evidence-based practices that we know work and have an impact and support districts in the deep implementation of those evidence-based practices through a multi-tiered system of support. Currently, the state of Minnesota is implementing several evidence-based practices, but the four that really stand out that we're seeing really promising results are and wish to expand through this initiative is the letters training. That's language essentials for teachers of reading and spelling, which is a professional development model for teachers in ensuring that they have the core knowledge and basic skills to teach early literacy. Building assets and reducing risks, otherwise known as the BAR program, which is focused on social emotional support systems. And really the PBIS work that the state is doing statewide, as well as the early childhood pyramid model, which is basically PBIS for early learners. So we feel that by focusing on evidence-based practices and really providing a higher level of support through the regional centers of excellence and getting some specialized staff in those centers, we could really support districts and have a greater impact on our academic and social-emotional learning. The next area around ensuring every student learns in a safe and nurturing environment. As you know, the voluntary pre-K seats, there's a section of them that are due to sunset. So this proposal maintains the voluntary pre-K seats as well as requires the kindergarten entry profile, which is will give us impact data on the effect of voluntary pre-K. And you can see by this chart that the funding would maintain 4,000 VPK and school readiness seats that expire in fiscal year 22, and as well as require the kindergarten entry profile. And in the next slide, a few other early learning proposals, mostly technical. One is to ensure the membership hours for kindergarten students with a disability are the same as the average daily membership calculation for other kindergarten students. The other is to fix and ensure students receiving early childhood special ed services are eligible and receive EL services, as well as the school breakfast reimbursement program, similar or just like VPK and their SRP, School Readiness Plus peers. And then the other one is to reduce the time to select a program for early learning scholarships to allow the award of more funds. So reducing the number of months to select a program from 10 to 3 months solves two main issues. Underuse of the scholarship by a child awarded a scholarship and promoting the child receiving the quality early learning experiences earlier, rather than losing months of that opportunity. And with a waiting list of eligible children that's reached nearly 3,000 statewide by June 30th of 2020, sooner identifying when a child will use their scholarship is essential to being able to award the scholarship funding to a child who is on the wait list. And in addition to world-class education, and expanding opportunities for students of color and Indigenous students. So these proposals look at expanding rigorous coursework, ethnic studies, Indigenous education for all, American Indian package, and a few other items that I will briefly give an overview to. So expanding rigorous coursework. So it's increasing access to AP IB and CTE and concurrent enrollment courses, create regional partnerships and statewide programs to support professional development and incentives to expand coursework, and to provide local matches to support rigorous coursework expansion and statewide CTE program quality improvements. This opportunity is really will expand access for those in greater Minnesota and for those that are historically underserved in all parts of the state. Next is ethnic studies for all. Ethnic studies are academic standards that promote racial equity, reduce implicit bias, encourage curricula that recognizes the complex history and contributions of communities of color and indigenous communities and the impact of racism in the United States. So according to the National Conference of State Legislators, several states are already embedding ethnic studies into their standards, including Washington, Nevada, Illinois, and California. And the process for adopting and supporting implementation of the ethnic studies across academics would include an evaluation process, use of demographic data, development of standards that are reflective of racial and cultural backgrounds of students, identification of reviewing exemplary multicultural curricula for different grade levels, and providing training and support for teachers on culturally sustaining pedagogies for instruction. This proposal also includes one staff member to provide expertise for adopting and including ethnic studies in all standards, as well as providing implementation assistance and professional development. And
Assistant Commissioner, if I can pause you for a moment, Representative Drazkowski has a question. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question is for Ms. Yetter. I could wait till she's done with her presentation.
Oh, thank you very much. Assistant Commissioner, why don't you continue, and when you're done, we'll go back to Ms. Yetter for Representative Drazkowski's question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. The next area is around Indigenous education for all. Every Minnesotan, whether Indigenous or not, should be encouraged to learn about the distinct and unique heritage of American Indians in culturally responsive manner, including tribal history, culture, treaty rights, contemporary tribal and state government institutions and relations, and the contributions of American Indian tribal nations and urban Indigenous communities to the state. So this is two MDE staff, one in academic standards and the other in the American Indian Division, and ongoing grants to the Tribal Nations Education Committee to consult on the standards implementation and development process, and a one-time competitive grant process to organizations to develop tribally endorsed, historically accurate, culturally embedded, place-based, contemporary, and developmentally appropriate Indigenous curriculum. And next, we have American Indian education. So for probably the past 2 years, in my prior role as Director of Early Learning, we had ongoing conversations with our tribal partners just around their needs in the area of early learning and early care and education. And the three areas that really kept surfacing to the top is additional support for family engagement in education, support for increasing language and literacy outcomes through language revitalization efforts, and enhancing teaching practices and efforts to support teacher diversity and really encourage Indigenous participation in teaching or teacher higher ed programs. So this first package of $3.3 million annually will support those three areas that surfaced as high need. And the second is kind of a long coming technical fix to ensure that with our Head Start funds that the tribal Head Start programs have a set aside, and regardless of the federal allocation process and the changes in formula, that the tribals are always guaranteed 10.72% of the $25.1 million that the state currently allocates. And American Indian Education, looking to extend the Indian Education Aid to joint powers districts, clarify intended recipients of the American Indian Aid are American Indian students. That's a no cost, and fund technology and resources to provide data analysis of American Indian student indicators and reporting of American Indian student counts. In addition, with American Indian Education, codify in statute tribal nations and tribal nation education committee involvement in the academic standards process. Cover more of the cost of attendance for Minnesota Indian teacher training program, and provide funds each year to partner with the tribal nations to provide tribal nations relation training to superintendent and charter school leaders. Other items in this area are align the physical education standards into the 10-year cycle, clarify that the post-secondary enrollment option is for opportunities that meaningfully generate post-secondary and secondary credit, and narrow the factors that would qualify students for state-approved alternative programs to those focused on the purpose of the program, which is credit recovery. And with that, I will turn it back over to Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Actually, Deputy Commissioner, if we could pause and ask Ms. Yetter, because Representative Drazkowski had a question for her. Representative Drazkowski.
Chair Dabney, it would appear as though Representative Drazkowski is not on the call at the moment. So let's circle back to him when he logs back in.
All right, Deputy Commissioner Mueller, back to you then.
Okay, thank you very much. So as we start thinking about every student has a teaching and learning environment with caring and qualified educators, we really are thinking of four things: a statewide teacher mentor program, a growing our own expansion, educator career pathways, and then also non-exclusionary discipline training. So when we think talking about a statewide mentoring program, we know that one, we have a pipeline problem, and we recognize that there are fewer and fewer students who are interested in going into education, and we have work to do because it is a wonderful profession. And we want people to see how amazing it is, and we want our young people to understand the role that this plays in the lives of students and families and for themselves intrinsically. But we also know that once we have educators in their classrooms and in their settings, there's work that we need to do to ensure that in their first, second, and third years of teaching, that we are supporting them by providing them with additional supports in professional development, helping them with their content, helping to support them even as they are navigating the school system and structure. And so that requires us, that helps to then to support retention in years to come. And so looking at developing a competitive grant process with roughly $4.5 million in competitive grants to develop that regional, that mentoring support and partnership in new training and technical assistance. It also allows us $250,000 for contracts with some of our national contact experts in developing that induction model. And then some dollars set aside, $250,000 set aside for the grant administration and the work that needs to be done there. But it's a really important component in order to continue to support our educators as they're coming into the profession. Also then moving to grow your own, we know that we have amazing educators who have not yet gone to school and had to have a degree in education, or they've gone to school but don't have a degree in education. And they are sitting in our classrooms, they are working alongside of our students, they are in our school systems and structures. And so what we wanna be able to do is increase our grow your own funds by $2 million annually to add really a third pathway for our districts and charters to develop their teaching workforce. It's gonna allow us to modify the eligibility criteria for teacher in residency, for the paraprofessional pathway, and it opens up opportunities for additional improved teacher prep programs. It also then expands the pathway and the amount of time and the time frame for up to 5 years. And so it's a really important piece because we know we have amazing people who need the opportunity and need the support to be able to go into education, and we want to support them in that pathway. If we want to think then also about how do we want to build that pipeline, We want our students to know how amazing education is, and we want them to start to have that pathway. As we think about building pathways in career and technical education, and we think about internships and apprenticeships and programs, we recognize that we build that on the pillars of our economy, right? We think about the pillars of our economy in a community, and you also think about that for our state. Education is one of those pillars. And so we are developing competitive grants for districts and charters to create those pathways. One of those is to create the pathways for teaching cohorts or students in high schools, including job shadowing and apprenticeships. Also establishing a tuition incentive for teachers to obtain credentials for teaching in concurrent enrollment. And then a 50-50 matching grant to develop an educator internship program pilot as an alternative pathway to the traditional teacher certification. And that is geared not only at expanding the pathway of educators in education, but also diversifying our workforce and diversifying the students who see themselves as educators. And then also then a really important piece is the work that we need to do around non-exclusionary discipline training. We know that we have a disproportionate number of students of color and indigenous students, as well as students who also receive special education services, who are identified in discipline and in our data. They are overrepresented in suspensions and overrepresented in discipline. And what this gives us the opportunity to do is really to, one, look at the policies and practices that we have in place and ensure that they are focused specifically on discipline and not on punishment. And two, it gives us the opportunity to build a team at the Department of Education to help to support that work in non-exclusionary and anti-bias professional development, in building a structure that is culturally relevant and is based on best practices in discipline.
Deputy Commissioner?
Yes.
This may be a good place to stop, to pause for today. I appreciate the fact that the department is giving us a full and detailed presentation. That's what this committee needs and expects in the department is doing that, and I appreciate that. I also understand that you're willing to come back on Tuesday. This is a big proposal from the Walz administration. It's nuanced, it's insightful, it's thoughtful, and that takes a little bit of time, and you've had a few questions as well. So members, we will pick up apparently on this slide on Tuesday and complete the presentation from the department on Governor Walz's Due North budget at that time. With that, to the presenters, thank you very much for your time and insights today. Members, thank you very much for your time and attention. Enjoy a good weekend to stay home. Stay safe. Thank you all. We are adjourned.
Thank you.